The Kingdom of the Beloved Son, an introduction to Colossians, chapter 1, verses 12 through 20, was presented by Ryan Carroll on March 21, 2010, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Carroll. Some of you know me. Others of you may not. My wife and I, Jen, live in Eugene. I'm a teacher, and we just had a daughter about 8 months ago. Her name's Riley. She's not here today. Anyway, I've been given the opportunity to teach today. I feel a little trepidatious, excuse me, but I'm going to go ahead anyway and just take a different tact and let you guys know that I'm kind of a big deal. So here we go. I promised Jen I wouldn't say that. Okay, So I'm going to be taking 2 weeks, this week and next week, and my ultimate goal is to work through a passage in Colossians. It's chapter 1. I'm going to read that today. We're not actually going to go through the passage today, verse by verse. We will do that next week. What I intend to do today is take time to provide what I think is a really important background to the text, without which I think that the text is rather impenetrable. I've been working on Colossians, translating, thinking about it for the last couple years, with some guidance from Jack Crabtree, and I'm going to be presenting some of the stuff that I will be presenting to you is what I've been thinking about for a while. So I'm going to go ahead and read the text in Colossians. You can open your Bibles, and we'll go from there. It's chapter 1, verse 12. We'll start. And I'm not going to give any sort of background to the letter itself this week. I will wait till next week. But I will go ahead and read it, make a few comments, and then jump into what I really want to do today. Colossians 1:12, giving thanks, Paul is praying to God and thanking the Father for his readers. And he's saying that we're giving thanks to the Father, who has qualified us, NASB text, to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. For he delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have the redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself might come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. Okay, so before I jump in, I want to just mention that I think the most important thing that we could do to understand this particular text is to start with what Paul says back up in verse 13. It's the phrase, the kingdom of the beloved Son. So today I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the language, where that language comes from, kind of outline that for you so that next week we can actually jump into the passage itself. Before I go back into the Old Testament, I want to mention that both the traditional view of this passage, which I'll talk more about next week, as well as my view, both hold the Son, who is Jesus of Nazareth, in very high regard. But both do so, I'm going to assert, for different reasons, from different perspectives, and I think with some differing implications. And we'll talk about that more when we get to next week. I also want to point out that I think that, like all passages in the New Testament, and especially this one, this tends to be kind of an enigmatic passage. It is vital that we understand the background that Paul is bringing to what he's saying, as you all know. And depending on the lens that you bring to the passage, you really end up with very, very different takes on what Paul is actually doing here. So I just wanted to kind of put that out, and I'm going to present for you the lens that I think is going to be the most helpful. I will try to end with plenty of time for questions, and we'll go from here. So we're going to be kind of bouncing around the Old Testament this afternoon. The language, the phrase from Colossians, the kingdom of the beloved Son, is, well, we need to understand it, and we need to know what the title Son means. And I know that a number of you have spent some time thinking about this or have heard others talk about this. So some of this may be review for others, it may not be. Okay, so first of all, where do these titles come from? Son, Son of God, Son of Man? That's the first question. The second question, and I think it's related, and we'll talk more about how, and that is where did the title Messiah come from and Christ come from? And are there differences between these titles? Do they mean the same thing? And my plan is to sort of take a look at where they come from, what they mean, what's behind it for Paul. My sort of put this out there at the outset. I want to sort of assert that Messiah and Christ mean the exact same thing, and they are the respective Hebrew and Greek terms for anointed or anointed one, that is Mashiach and Christos. And the titles Son, Son of Man, and Son of God also all refer to one and the same grouping of individuals, and I do use the plural there purposefully. And I am going to assert that they mean equivalently the same thing, and we'll discuss that as we go. So I'm going to kind of start by getting a little bit into the history of Israel and ultimately end up in 2 Samuel chapter 7 with the Davidic covenant. So, first of all, after Israel gets brought out of Egypt, God gives them the covenant, Moses brings it to the people, and Moses ultimately doesn't get to go into the land of Canaan, but Joshua does. And Joshua, we read, was, the language is something like the spirit of the Lord or spirit of wisdom came upon him. And Joshua takes the people in. They settle the land. Joshua dies. Judges come who rule over the people. And of course, during this whole time, Israel, as God said that they would, is being fairly unfaithful to the covenant that he's made with them. Now, I point this out, first of all, because the title Messiah in evangelical sort of circles, we tend to think that this title is fairly specific to the one person, that is Jesus, who came, died on the cross, and was raised again. But the reality is that the Jews and Israel themselves believe that the Joshua was a Messiah, that the judges who came, for example, like Samson, these were also Messiahs. They had the Spirit of the Lord anoint them to deliver the people, to judge the people. So the term Messiah is not a unique term to Jesus himself. And that's going to be a really important key point as we move along towards understanding all these other names, son of God, that sort of thing. Time passes. Joshua dies. The judges come and go. And ultimately, when we get to 1 Samuel, Samuel is born, and he ends up becoming both prophet and judge over Israel. And he rules for most of his life. And it's important to note that once he gets older, he gives some of his responsibilities to his sons. And what we read in the text is that his sons were not quite as faithful both to the people and to God as he was. So if you would actually turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8, I just want to point that out real quickly. Now, ultimately, the Mosaic Covenant, while you guys are turning, calls for a judge to render rulings for the people on behalf of God. And so all the judges, including Samuel, have been doing just that. And we come to a point in Israel's history where the people are getting tired of having Samuel and his sons as judges over them. And so this is what we read in chapter 8. And it came about, verse 1, when Samuel was old, that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second, Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord. Now, ultimately, when Samuel hears the people demand a king, he's displeased and he ends up praying to God and asking God about it. And God's response ultimately is that, "Samuel, the people are not rejecting you as judge, but they are in fact rejecting me as God over them." And that's a really important point that we're going to kind of flesh out a little bit. Once God tells Samuel this, Samuel turns to the people and he says, "You guys, this is a terribly wicked thing that you are asking for. And indeed, you don't really know what you're asking for." And so God had told Samuel, it instructed Samuel later in chapter 8, to tell the people what exactly it would mean to have a king over them. And I'm not going to read through it, but I'm just going to highlight a few things. Basically, he says, the king's going to turn you into servants, his own servants. The king's going to tax you and force health care upon you. Really, it's in the text. You should check it out. The king is also going to take your sons and your daughters and use them. And then he ultimately says, God has delivered you from the tyranny of Pharaoh and the other surrounding kingdoms, and you really want to put another human king over you? And so the people listen to this, and all the more they end up saying, no, we want a king. We shall have a king for over ourselves who will fight our battles, who will judge us, who will go before us, and this is what we want. So God says, give them what they want, okay? Now, of course, we all know that God says, but I'm going to get to choose. And so he first chooses Saul, and we know how that ended fairly badly. Saul ends up starting out well. He has some good exploits in terms of he and the army. But ultimately, he starts to disobey the voice of the Lord. And God ends up rejecting him as king. Well, then David comes along, and God says, I'm going to choose another, and you will appoint him as king. And it's important to point out that both Saul and David are given the title of Mashiach. They are messiahs. And we all know, for example, when David has a chance to end Saul's life, he says, far be it from me that I would raise my hand against the Lord's anointed, his Messiah. So again, Joshua, the judges, the first couple kings of Israel, all have this title Mashiach or Messiah given to them. They are literally God's appointed or anointed people to lead his men to lead his people. So, I want to just read my notes at this point. I said it really well, and I'm just going to read it word for word. So bear with me. So here's my initial thoughts on what I've just told you. Now, when Israel asks for a king, they are explicitly rejecting the rule that God has provided for them. They aren't willing to have an invisible God fight their battles and render rulings through the prophets and judges anymore. They want a king like the surrounding nations. By asking for this thing, Israel, the people of God, are rejecting their God and his rule that brought them out of Egypt and made them a people in the first place. God's response, as we read through Samuel, is that this was indeed an evil thing for the people to ask for. The request showed that they were not simply rejecting their God-appointed judge, but rather they were rejecting God himself. However, Samuel tells the people, and we read on in chapter 8, 9, 10, etc. Samuel tells the people that even though they are rejecting God and his rule, that God is not willing to reject them from being his people. Even though he is angered by the request and rejection, God still desires to be faithful to his ultimate promises he's made to his people, and therefore does not reject them as his people, but remarkably grants them their evil request. He gives them what they want. But notice, in granting Israel their request for a king, like the surrounding nations, God doesn't simply let them choose their own king to suit their own liking. Rather, he takes on the project of choosing who this king will be. Why does he do this? Why not just say, fine, do whatever you want, I don't care. God will use the occasion to transition the way he himself rules over the people. The people have rejected his rule through the judges and have asked for a king instead. Therefore, God is going to give them a king. But the rules haven't changed. The king, like the judge, is still supposed to render rulings and judgments on God's behalf. The king, like the judge, is not supposed to pervert justice and be dishonest. What has changed, though, is that unlike the judge, who merely represented God's will concerning specific rulings and decisions, the king himself will actually be the physical, visible representative of God, not just his will concerning societal issues that arose in Israel. Therefore, to reject the king will be to reject God himself. It was important, therefore, if the king was to represent God in this way, that the king not only be one who was open to God, but one who obeyed his voice regarding how to rule. so that he, as king, would as closely as possible represent God to the people. That is why, after Saul is chosen as the first king, we see that when he fails to heed God's instructions as to what he should do and how he should rule over the people, God rejects him from being king and finds another man to take his place. And who is that? David, who we are told is a man after God's own heart. That is, a man who desires and values the things of God, a man who will want to serve the purposes of God rather than his own, albeit imperfectly. God wants a man to be king over his people who will represent him, his judgment, his wisdom, and his values. In so doing, God shows that he still very much wants to rule over his people, but he now seems willing to do it by proxy, through a man who is appointed as Messiah and king. Okay. Now, maybe lots of questions around that. We can certainly talk back there. Now, all that is to set us up for David has become king, and after he is confirmed as both king over Judah and Israel, because there was sort of a period of civil war, he settles, and we're told that he has he's been given peace all around him, something that neither Saul nor he have had yet. Now, if you would turn your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 7, what we're going to look at now is what is called, or tends to be called, the Davidic covenant. And it's important to note, before we look at the covenant, that it's important to keep everything I've just said sort of in your mind, that when God actually makes this covenant with David, all of what's just happened needs to be in our background. Chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, David decides that he wants to build the temple that is going to house the Ark of the Covenant. And he is now living in a quite nice sort of three-bedroom house with wood floors and that sort of thing. And he decides that, hey, if I'm living in a house, God should be living in a house. So he wants to build a temple for the ark. He tells, is it Nathan at this point? Yeah, thank you, Nathan at this point. He tells Nathan of his plans, and Nathan hears from God and comes back to David, and this is what we read is God's response to David's desire. Verse 8. Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, this is God speaking to Nathan, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again. Nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you, David. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant or your seed after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever, In accordance with all these words and all the vision, so Nathan spoke to David. Okay, so I'm going to talk through kind of the highlights of what just has been told to David. Now, first of all, God says, I don't want you to build me a house. Your son's going to do that, one who comes after you. But I'm going to build you a house. And this is sort of a metaphorical language for a dynasty that God is going to cause to spring forth from the lineage of David. And so that's the first promise, is that David is going to have a dynasty that will last, and it will last forever. The second promise is, and it is very much related to the first, is that when you die, your dynasty isn't going to die with you. Your son is going to carry this on. And so it's your son who is going to end up building a house for me. So we all know that Solomon, son of David, ends up being the king who has the temple of the Lord built. Now, not only that, but just as I'm promising to you, I'm going to promise to your son who comes after you, your descendant who comes after you, your throne and his throne are going to be confirmed forever. It's a long time. Longer than Saul got to hang out. Now, I'm going to skip the father-son thing for a moment and go on to the next piece of the covenant. The next part of the covenant, he says, when your son or when the son ends up needing correction and discipline, I will correct him. And he says the language is with the rod of men. But take note, David, that unlike the way I have acted towards Saul, if you or your descendants screw up, I'm not going to take the throne away from you. I took it away from Saul, but I am going to be faithful to my promise to you to keep your throne, to keep the throne in your family, so to speak. And then ultimately, the last piece of it is that in 15 and 16 is, again, God reiterates to David that his kingdom will be forever. Now, I skipped a piece of that, and I want to come back to it right now, and that is the language that we see in verse 14, where God says, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. Now, kind of odd language to show up in this passage. It kind of comes out of nowhere. The question is, what does God have in mind? Where's this language of father and son coming from? So I want to talk about that a little bit. And just mention that some of what I'm going to say has come from some thinking that Jack has done. Also, there is a book that I have read. It's titled King and Messiah as Son of God. And it was written by a husband and wife. He's an Old Testament scholar and she's a New Testament scholar, I think from Yale Divinity School or something like that. I want to sort of delve into this language of son and father, because ultimately I'm going to suggest that the titles that are given to Jesus, son of man, son of God, son of David, all come from this, and it's pretty important. So, now, first of all, the language and concept of son and father, which God uses, is most likely drawn from the surrounding nations in the ancient Near East and their concept and their understanding of their king's relationship to their God. Okay? It's fairly well documented, and it makes a whole lot of sense. So I'll talk through that a little bit. First of all, there's evidence in Damascus that the king of Damascus was called the son of Hadad, that is, after their god. In Syria, there's evidence that at least one king held the title son of Rahib after one of their gods. But most of the evidence that we have for this language and this concept of the king being the son of a nation's god comes from Egypt. And of course, Israel has to be on some level very familiar with whatever kind of language and understanding that the Egyptians had in terms of who their pharaoh was and what his relationship to the Egyptian gods and the pantheon was. So the Egyptian pharaohs were very much considered to be sons of Ra, the chief Egyptian god. There are lots of evidence, inscriptions to suggest this, that the father-son relationship between Ra and the pharaohs was very much in the forefront. And they all, the evidence that has been put together has all predates the monarchic period in Israel, which is another important thing to note. One particular inscription found on reliefs at the temple of Amenophis III has the god declaring, "He is my son on my throne in accordance with the decree of the gods." There is a coronation ceremony of one Egyptian ruler that was unearthed. The text goes, "You are my son, the heir who came forth from my flesh." During the time of Ramses II, another inscription, "I am your father who have begotten you as a god and your members as gods." Also, the motif that gets written in and recorded in Psalm 110, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet," this very much is believed to be an Egyptian motif. They have found iconography depicting the Egyptian pharaohs sitting at the right hand of their deity, indeed with their enemies underneath their feet. And so all that to say is this language and this concept of son being the king and father being the god is very much well and alive in the ancient Near East. And my assertion is that when God uses the language, "I will be a father to him," that is the descendant that comes from you, "and he will be a son to me," that's what he has in mind, and I would assert that that's what David's understanding and that concept would be very much available to David. So, in what, if any sense, were the kings in the ancient Near East considered to be actually divine? Scholars disagree about what exactly the Egyptians believed about the relationship to the pharaoh to Re. Some believe that the Egyptians very much thought that this was a literal relationship, father-son relationship, that Pharaoh very much was begotten or spawned, I guess, from their god. Others take the language and believe that the people really didn't assume that it was literal language, but that it was more metaphorical in nature, that what God and what, for example, what the people understood was that the ruler, the pharaoh, was got his authority from being the son in a metaphorical sense. It's sort of all, there's a lot of questions about that, but the question is, what does God mean by it, and what is he doing with it, and how does David understand it? Now, so I'm going to talk through that a little bit. But I guess before I do, I just want to make sure that it's pointed out that I think that this this concept of the son-father relationship between a king and the nation's God is exactly what is in view here with the Davidic covenant. And the title son, son of man, son of God, all refer to that relationship and all mean generally the same thing. What's the difference between son of man, son of God? Some people may disagree with me about this. I think ultimately it's just they're the same thing from a different perspective. Son of man is this is the man who has been sort of called out of that pool of people, called men to be the son. It's sort of a partitive genitive in the Hebrew. Joking. Anyway, and son of God just is this is the son who has been appointed by God. Okay. Now, what do these mean? How do we understand them? Well, to understand that and to figure that out, we need to kind of take a look at what is David's understanding of the language. And we have quite a lot of Psalms and information that gives us sort of some insight into David being called the son and what that meant for him. And we'll talk through that right now. So, first of all, the first thing that I want to point out is in 1 Chronicles chapter 28 and 29, if you'd like to turn there. This is towards the end of David's life, and he is about to pass on the kingdom to Solomon. And he is kind of not quite sure. He's got all of Israel assembled in front of him, that is at least the elders and the leaders. And he says this in verse 5. "And of all of my sons, for the Lord has given me many sons, he has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel." Hold on to that thought for a second. Go to chapter 29. In chapter 29, verse 23, start in 22. "And they made Solomon the son of David king a second time, and they anointed him," that is, made him Messiah, "as ruler for the Lord, and Zadok as priest. Then Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord as king instead of David." Now, first insight that I want to point out is that David's understanding and the chronicler's understanding is that as son, David and Solomon are sitting on the throne of God. And the language gets used, the language that is used gives us the idea that these guys aren't just kings over Israel. They aren't just the people's king. They're actually sitting on, metaphorically, the throne of God. They're ruling on God's behalf. Okay? First point. Now, we're going to note that, I want to stop here to note real quickly that David was a son, Solomon was a son, Solomon's seed was a son of God, and so on and so forth. They were all given the titles of son of God. And the first thing to note, as we just have seen, is that the son is sitting on the throne of Yahweh. And that's going to ultimately mean that, as I mentioned before, their rule represents God's rule, Yahweh's rule. Okay. Next, if you want to turn to Psalm 8. Psalm 8 is often labeled a messianic psalm. And I think whenever I heard that term growing up and that sort of thing, I always thought, oh, messianic psalm, that must mean it's a prophetic psalm that has to do with later things. Well, messianic psalm just is that it's David talking about, his role as Messiah. So in Psalm 8, we see for the first time the title Son of Man. And again, I'm going to assert that Son of God, Son of Man, same thing. We read in Psalm 8, verse 4, "What is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Yet thou hast made him a little lower than God, and dost crown him with glory and majesty. Thou dost make him to rule over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet." Now, the second thing to note is that, first of all, David sits on the throne of Yahweh. His rule represents the rule of God. Second thing to note is that the Son of Man, that is David, he has been elevated to the status of a little lower than God. And not only that, but he has been put, that God has put under the Son of Man, is put all things in subjection under him. That is all of creation, as it says. Thou hast made him to rule over the works of thy hands. So firstly, as the Son, he sits on the throne of Yahweh. As the Son, secondly, he rules over all creation. Thirdly, I want to turn to right now Psalm 2, if you will. And I am so going to run out of time. Psalm 2, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about Psalm 2 in a minute, but we read in Psalm 2, verse 8, actually starting in verse 7, "I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as thine inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as thy possession. And thou shalt break them with the rod of iron, and thou shalt shatter them like earthenware. First of all, so the most important thing to note there is that he is giving the Son the nations as an inheritance. And without turning there, we have recorded for us in Psalm 18 the statement that David, I think, is making, that nations who do not know me serve me. So the third thing to note is that as the Son of God, he also rules over all the nations. So he is on the throne of Yahweh, he rules over creation, and he rules over all the nations, because as the Son, and because God is true God, that the idea is that this is God's creation, these are God's people, Israel, as well as everybody that he's created, that the Son, who represents God's rule, rules over all the nations. Now, next, all of the kings of Israel, as I mentioned, were sons of God, and Psalm 2 and Psalm 110, which I will just allude to, are very much believed to be psalms that were read at the enthronement of the new king. So when Solomon's done and his son takes over and his son, each time a coronation happens, most scholars believe that probably Psalm 2 and Psalm 110 would have been read. So the language that we read in Psalm 2, "Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee," ultimately represents probably the begetting, the idea of God begetting the Son, is the idea that on the day when the Son takes over, that's the day when God sort of makes him his son. Now, couple other things I want to point out. First of all, if you would turn to Psalm 45, Psalm 45 was a psalm written on the occasion of one of the king's marriages. I don't know if it was Solomon's or David's. Other people may be able to help me out with that later. But one thing that I want to point out is that we also see in Psalm 45, the king himself being given the title of God, of Elohim. Read real quickly with me. I'll cut this down a little bit. Start in verse 3. Gird thy sword on thy thigh, O mighty one, in thy splendor and thy majesty, and in thy majesty ride on victoriously. This is the psalmist talking to the king. For the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness, let thy right hand teach thee awesome things. Thine arrows are sharp, the peoples fall under thee, that is, the sun. Thine arrows are in the heart of the king's enemies. Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of uprightness is the scepter of thy kingdom. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, thy God, has anointed thee with the oil of joy above thy fellows. So here we have in Psalm 45, the king actually being spoken to, being written about, and being given the title of Elohim, of simply God. So there are a few other places where that happens, and I will note one in a moment. But before we do, I want to look at one more psalm. If you would turn to Psalm 89, there's one more important thing that I want to note as we flip through the psalms. Psalm 89 is a psalm of David. He is recounting in the psalm the covenant that God has made with him. And I'm going to read a couple parts of it. We'll start in verse 1. I will sing of the loving kindness of the Lord forever. To all generations I will make known thy faithfulness with my mouth. For I have said, loving kindness will be built up forever. In the heavens thou wilt establish thy faithfulness. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to David, my servant, I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. Now I want to skip real quickly to verse 19. Once thou didst speak in a vision to thy godly ones and didst say, I have given help to the one who is mighty. I have exalted one chosen from the people. I have found David, my servant. With my holy oil I have anointed him, that is, made him Messiah, with whom my hand will be established. My arm also will strengthen him. The enemy will not deceive him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him. But I shall crush his adversaries before him and strike those who hate him. And my faithfulness and my loving kindness will be with him. Again, sort of the motif from the covenant itself. And in my name his horn will be exalted. I will also set his hand on the sea and his right hand on the rivers. He will cry to me, thou art my father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. I shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. My loving kindness I will keep for him forever, and my covenant shall be confirmed to him. Now, just wanted to point out that one of the titles that is given or understood in David's mind is that he has become the firstborn of God. Now, I am going to suggest, especially next week, because this term shows up in Colossians a couple times, that this is very much a messianic title, and that God is in the sense of in Israel when the firstborn son is born and all the sons or daughters come after him, that the father, when he passes on, gives gives his basically 51% of all that he has to his firstborn. And so I think the idea that God is suggesting here is that his son, the firstborn, that is David, is going, his inheritance will be the entire earth. And on top of that, he is the highest of all the kings of the earth. We'll talk more about that next week. Now, just to recap, covenant of David. David's descendants will rule over Israel eternally. God will enter into a special relationship with David and his offspring. I will be a father to him and he will be a son to me. What does this mean? The title son is most likely used by God in parallel to the surrounding nations' understanding of their king's special relationship to their God. The king rules on behalf of the God and is very much the human embodiment of the God. Yahweh, in borrowing the language, demythologizes this concept and actualizes it by being the true God who has selected a human representative. The titles son, son of man, son of God all mean the same thing and originate with this covenant. These titles were given to David and his offspring who sat on the throne of Israel, all of whom were mere men. David's understanding of the covenant is that he as the son has been elevated to the status of being a little lower than God. He as the son has been made ruler over God's creation. He as the son has been granted to sit on the throne of God, being the embodiment of the rule and authority of God within creation. And he as the son has not only been made ruler over Israel, but has been made ruler over all nations and peoples. But there is one problem. Psalm 82 is an interesting note. You can go there if you want. The psalmist is basically bemoaning the fact that all of these sons are wicked. They don't judge rightly. They're evil, and they pervert God's rule. And it's most notably interesting to note that, again, in that psalm, the people the psalmist is talking to are given the title Elohim. The sons, again, are titled with the title God. So David and the sons who follow him don't ever truly actualize their rule over all the creation and the nations. Indeed, they are poor representatives for the rule of Yahweh. All of these sons are only symbolic placeholders, I would assert. While they indeed rule over Israel, their rule over creation and all the nations as the son of Yahweh is never truly actualized. The problem is that, as I've mentioned, David and his direct descendants, while they were supposed to represent God and the rule of God, they did not embody the authority and rule of Yahweh because they did not have the character, judgment, and wisdom of Yahweh, being merely sinful human beings. True, all were messiahs. All were granted the titles sons of God, but all were sinful, evil, depraved men like me. They fell far short of being the visible fulfillment of God's rule for his people. Now, this leads to the next point, and I've got 4 minutes to do this. So, God makes good on his promise to sweep the people and the king away because they fail to obey him. Israel is first hauled off into captivity by Assyria. Judah, secondly. During this time of the hauling off, of the dispersion, God sends the prophets to remind the people of his promises and faithfulness, even in the face of severe discipline that he's bringing in the form of other nations. And the prophets are bringing the message to the people that God will indeed bring along his unique, righteous Messiah king from David's lineage, who will come and reestablish God's rule over the people of Israel and truly rule over the nations and all of creation. as well as reestablish his people on their own land. Empires rise, empires fall, while the remnant of believing Jews down through the generations hope and wait for God to fulfill his promise. Now, Jesus is born. And the gospel writers, it's important to note, pay particular attention to the relationship that Jesus of Nazareth has with David. Okay, very beginning of Matthew, we have the lineage of Jesus. And it's important to note that it is stated that Jesus is the son of Abraham, the son of David, the son of Abraham. The man Jesus, according to the gospel accounts, is indeed the unique awaited son of David who will truly embody the character and rule of God. But the problem, particularly for the Jews, was that he didn't look or act at all like the promised and expected son, Messiah and king, who would restore the kingdom of Israel to its proper place and rule on behalf of God over all creation and the nations. Indeed, far from ruling over all the nations, Jesus can't even get himself enough, you know, moxie to get himself ruling over Israel. And on top of that, he took no glory to himself, appeared to play fast and loose with the Mosaic covenant, went about with a motley crew that didn't fast when they were supposed to or pray like they were supposed to, and to top it all off, he gets himself killed. Some awaited Messiah. But as it is recorded in John's gospel account, he was the unique and long-awaited son, because as we are told, and this is the most important thing that I want to note, he represented the teaching, wisdom, judgment, and actions of God so uniquely that finally a son of God could truly and accurately say of himself, "I and my Father are one." But we don't just take his word for it, but rather God himself confirms it so by raising this man from the dead. The final confirmation that ever so clearly and remarkably indeed states that it's this man who will one day physically and visibly rule on God's behalf. But for now, it has been granted that he sits at the right hand of God, waiting for his enemies to be made a footstool for his feet. One day, Jesus will have his rule actualized. He will rule over the new creation and the kingdom of God. And in that day, the kingdom of the Son, spoken of by Paul in Colossians, will be glorious. So, just to kind of wrap it all up before I take your questions, all of what I just said is what I think Paul has in mind when he uses that phrase, the kingdom of the beloved Son, in Colossians. And my assertion is going to be that we have to understand this idea that God wants to have a man visibly and physically ruling on his behalf over his people and over his creation. And I think that, and that'll be more clear as we look in Colossians, but ultimately, that's where, this is the lens, this is the understanding that we need to have to make sense of Colossians 1. So, I'm going to open it up to your questions and be merciful.
Hi. You were reading, so I think you could quote it again. Near the end, he something so uniquely that he could say, "I and the Father are one." Was it he represented? Is that the word you used? Embodied? And could you maybe read that again?
Yeah.
I think it's important. You know, it helps me know where you're going.
Absolutely. So Jesus was the unique and long-awaited Son because he represented the teaching, wisdom, judgment, and actions of God so uniquely that finally a son of God could actually say, "I and my Father are one."
Okay. And then one more question since I have the microphone. All those psalms that you were referencing,
yeah.
I think when I was growing up reading those psalms, I was thinking that the psalmist was kind of acting as a prophet and kind of bouncing back and forth between David and Jesus,
mm-hmm.
or a king and Jesus, and that it wasn't actually all about the king. So, and I don't know if that was ever taught to me or if that's just kind of what I assumed, because it was like Jesus language.
Right.
With a traditional view, would they actually say that you're misinterpreting some of those psalms? Or would they agree with your interpretation of those psalms?
That's a good question. I think that let me start here, and then maybe I'll answer your question. When you look at the fact that David is penning these words, and you look at the language that gets used in the Davidic covenant, and we have the concept and the understanding from the surrounding nations of this idea that the God of the nation is the father to the king, the human king. When we understand that, as well as, I just don't think that David was not let in on the big secret of Jesus. And so, and had he been, we'd probably have other things written. And it seems very clear that the words that he is saying, that he is referring to himself and to his own descendants, those that would come after and rule. So in terms of David having some sort of idea of the long sort of distant future, that one of his descendants would indeed rule eternally, maybe. But it's pretty clear to me that that David's referring to himself. Yeah.
One of the important questions to understand Colossians is to understand the audience that's reading the book. And one of the things is, are there Jews involved in the readers? And my question is that given this kind of language that Paul uses here about the kingdom of his beloved son,
mm-hmm.
would that kind of language indicate that there were Jews in the audience, or that Jews were part of the people who were going to, Paul is addressing here?
Yeah, that's a good question, Larry. I think, as I'll mention next week, the letter itself, I think, is written primarily to Gentile believers living in Colossae, who certainly had Jews among them. Regardless of whether or not Paul understood that he was writing his letter to both Jews and Gentiles, it's important to note that the gospel at that time and the conception that they had of who this Messiah was going to be, and he's the son, and Jesus is the one who fit that role, this would have all been language that would have been explained to them by whoever, in this case it was Epaphras, whoever had originally taught them the gospel. So certainly, whether Paul knows there's Jews that are reading his letter or not, he knows that his audience is well versed in understanding the gospel in terms of the Davidic covenant and that Jesus is the fulfiller of that. So, and we'll talk more about that next week.
Could you describe again the difference between a judge and a king? That went by kind of quick for me. And I've always wondered, what was it that the people wanted from a king that they weren't getting from a judge? And why did God see that as them rejecting him?
Yeah, that's... Sorry, was there an...
That's pretty much my question.
Okay. So Deuteronomy 17 is the place in the Mosaic Covenant that kind of speaks to both judges and kings. And the language, it seems, for the judge is that they are the ones that if people have an issue, if with, you know, under this new covenant, if there are questions as to how they're supposed to do this or that, or what this, you know, their own family situation, if they have an issue come up that that involves, you know, the legal matters concerning the covenant and how God wants them to live and et cetera, that they were to go to the judge, and the judge would tell them what they are to do. They would explain to them they would give them their ruling on whatever the issue was. In the language there, Moses says something to the effect of, you will not turn aside from the ruling of the judge to the left or to the right, because something like, it is the ruling of God or something like that. Therefore, don't act presumptuously and go against basically a de facto ruling of God. So it seems like the one difference is that the judge gives rulings that are to be in line with the will of God, whereas the king also certainly did the same thing, but that there was a step up in a sense that the king's it wasn't just the rulings of the king, it was that the king himself symbolized and represented God in a way that the judges never did, in so much as the king is really elevated in status, far above any judge's status that Israel ever had, that kind of thing. It's a good question, because I was actually, when I first was kind of reading through 1 Samuel 8, I was surprised that, you know, there's a little shock when you find out that God finds the thing evil, because the people, it says Samuel's sons were being dishonest and were perverting justice. So the people, of course, are upset about that. They're frustrated about that. So why not ask for something to be done about it? Well, in asking for a king, my take on it is that they are, as God says, rejecting him because the judge was supposed to be the sort of to render the rulings of God. So to go against a judge was to go against the rulings of God in some way, shape, or form. It also occurs to me that that God is, when the people ask, and they use the language, give us a king like all the nations, one of the things that's striking is that in the Mosaic Covenant, over and over and over again, that phrase, like all the nations around you, is a phrase that's used by God to basically mean, like, whatever they are doing, that's not what you should be doing. And so in asking for a king like the nations was also, in a sense, a rejection of God and his rule and what he had placed over them in terms of the judges. But I don't know if that answered all of your question. But
yeah, that's helpful. What do you think about the idea that a king would have more responsibility for the well-being of the people than the judge did? The king actually had a responsibility to, say, protect the people if they were attacked and that kind of thing, but the judge didn't. And so maybe the reason God was upset was God had said, you're my people, and mm-hmm. I'm protecting you, and that kind of thing, but it wasn't. Here they were in a situation where the judges were not doing the right thing, mm-hmm. and instead of interpreting that as, we need to go to God and get some help here, it's like, we need somebody to go to because we don't have anybody to go to. So we need a king that we can go to and say, help us here, because there's nobody else who's going to do it. We need somebody who's explicitly charged with protecting us from evil people, like these evil judges, or maybe when we get attacked, or maybe when we need health care or whatever. So is it, what do you think about that idea, that it's just that they didn't like the idea of their well-being being in the hands of somebody they couldn't see?
I think that's a point well made, and in fact that helps me remember that one of the things they actually asked for was set a king over us who can fight our battles and lead us out and that sort of thing. And of course, the history of Israel from the time of Egypt to this time was like, where's God? Come on, Moses. Like, really? We're out here in the middle of the wilderness and you're telling us to believe in this invisible God and we're out here kind of wasting away. And so, yeah, I think that there is something about a rejection of the invisible rule that God has over his people, that they want something more tangible. And part of that desire for tangibility might also be, is a rejection of everything the invisible God's already done for them, and in some way is a rejection of what God is doing for them. So, yeah. One more question?
Thank you. You're brave letting the new guy ask a question. First, I won't be here next week, so
okay.
I won't be able to hear the rest of this.
You can look it up online.
Okay. And I don't read the original Greek either, so I don't have a complete understanding. But I think this might help clarify the first guy's question a little bit. If you could just clarify from Psalm 45, verse 7, the relationship that you perceived of the word God and your God there. And then maybe I will have a question, maybe I won't.
Okay. So in verse 7 or just the whole thing?
Yeah, specifically, yep, therefore God, and then following that.
Okay, so what I am suggesting, and I could be wrong, I don't think so, but what I'm suggesting is back in verse 6, when the psalmist says, "Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever," that he is speaking to the king. That's the king he's talking to, and the idea is it's the king in David's line that has been given a everlasting throne, so "Thy throne, O God, is forever." Verse 7, "Thou hast loved righteousness and hated wickedness, therefore God, thy God, has anointed thee." So the first God is the king, and the second God is Yahweh, who is doing the anointing. So that would be my take on it.
Okay. Yeah, so then my question there is, it seems what you're saying is what you just clarified, therefore God, your God, has mm-hmm. set aside. The way I see it, and clearly just English translation and punctuation, it's therefore God, your God, has set you apart from your companions.
Yeah, that obviously has that could be the way to take it. I don't know Hebrew at all. One thing that is important to note, if that were the case, you still do have Psalm 82, where the psalmist is railing against the unrighteous kings. And there it says in verse 5, "They do not know, nor do they understand. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods. All of you are sons of the Most High. Nevertheless, you will die as men." So I would suggest another place, even if you're right about verse 7 and 45, which you may be, that here's another clear place where the kings themselves are given the title of Elohim. Yeah, yeah. 6 and 45 would still indicate the king being given or called God. So again, you know, I think this is new information to me within the last couple years, and it's taken me a while to kind of be, what? Like, really? Like, these titles were given to men, especially the title Elohim. So I don't know. Did you have anything else that you'd want to say about that? Or okay. Yeah. All right, go pick up your children.